Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are digging into a stack of notes that tracks a story I've been pretty obsessed with lately, mostly because it just refuses to sit still.
Oh, yeah.
You know those narratives that seem to live like a dozen different lives? They just keep reinventing themselves every decade or so.
Right, the cultural shapeshifters.
Exactly. And today we are tracking one of the absolute biggest shapeshifters in American literature, which is The Color Purple.
Yeah.
It starts, of course, as Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel back in 1982. Then, boom, 3 years later, it's a massive Steven Spielberg movie.
Right.
Then it becomes a Broadway musical. Then that musical gets a stripped-down revival. And then just recently, they make a movie of the musical.
It is essentially a nesting doll of adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes this specific deep dive so interesting isn't just that it kept getting remade.
No.
It's that the musical version of The Color Purple, and specifically the massive gap between the 2005 production and the 2015 revival, well, it tells us a huge amount about how we process trauma in art.
Oh, absolutely.
And how audience expectations completely change over time.
And that is exactly our mission for today. We aren't just going to recount the plot, though we will definitely touch on it. We're going to look at how this show premiered in 2005 as a massive, glittery blockbuster that critics absolutely shredded.
Yep, they really did.
Only to return 10 years later, stripped down to almost nothing. I mean, literally wooden chairs and fabric. And suddenly it's hailed as a spiritual masterpiece.
It really is a tale of two productions. One was called A Messy Patchwork, and the other was called A Ravishing Beauty.
Right.
And here is the kicker that I think people forget. They were working from the exact same script and the exact same score.
That is the wild discrepancy we really need to unpack. How does the same material produce such completely different reactions? But before we get to the critical drama, we need to set the foundation. For you listening, if you maybe haven't seen the musical, who actually put this thing together? Because converting Alice Walker's epistolary novel, which is written as Letters to God,
right,
converting that into a song and dance number seems like a massive high wire act.
It is a very eclectic team, which might actually explain some of the early friction.
Mm.
The book, and in theater terms, the book is the spoken script.
Right. The dialogue.
Exactly. That was written by Marcia Norman, who is a Pulitzer winner herself for Night Mother. So she knows heavy drama.
Okay.
But the music and lyrics came from a totally unique trio. Brenda Russell, Allie Willis, and Stephen Bray.
And that's a fascinating grouping for Broadway. These weren't your traditional theater composers like Sondheim or Lloyd Webber.
Far from it. These were pop heavyweights.
Yeah.
Allie Willis co-wrote September for Earth, Wind, and Fire, and she wrote the Friends theme song.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Stephen Bray was Madonna's frequent collaborator in the 80s, so you had a very pop-centric team tackling a story about incest, domestic abuse, and systemic racism in the Jim Crow South.
Which on paper sounds like it could go wrong in about 50 different ways.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like a massive clash of tones just waiting to happen.
It was a huge risk. But to their credit, they managed to blend jazz, ragtime, gospel, and blues
right
into a score that really grounds you in the era.
Right.
The story spans from 1909 through the mid-20th century in Georgia, and the music does a lot of the heavy lifting to establish that time passage.
Let's quickly ground the listener in that story because the emotional weight is so important for understanding the controversy later.
Mm-hmm.
We follow Celie.
Right. When we meet Celie, she is 14 years old. She is pregnant by her father, or the man she believes is her father, and she's eventually forced to marry a man she simply calls Mr.
The power dynamic is so skewed, she doesn't even use his first name.
Exactly. His name is Albert,
mm-hmm.
but to her, he is just an authority figure who owns her. It's a brutal beginning. Celie is separated from her sister, Nettie,
mm-hmm.
who is really her only lifeline to sanity. Mr. kicks Nettie out and actually hides her letters to Celie for decades.
So for a huge chunk of the show, Celie believes she's completely alone in the world, unloved and forgotten.
Yes.
But the narrative arc isn't just a downward spiral. It's about the network of women who help pull her out of that darkness.
And this is where the musical structure really shines, perhaps even more than the film in some ways. You have Sophia, who is the wife of Mr.'s son, Harpo.
Okay.
She is the physical embodiment of resistance. She flat out refuses to be beaten or silenced. She's the one who sings Hell No.
Which is essentially the anthem of the first act.
It is. It's a moment where the audience usually erupts because it's the first time someone stands up to the men in the story.
Right.
And then you have Shug Avery. She's a jazz singer. She's Mitsuko's longtime lover, but she ends up becoming the catalyst for Seeley's awakening.
And this is a key plot point we need to stick a pin in because it becomes a major point of contention with the critics. Seeley and Suge have a romantic sexual relationship.
Yes. It is central to Seeley realizing her own body and her own worth belong to her, not to Mr. or her father.
Okay.
It's the journey from somebody gonna love you, which she sings, to her stolen baby at the start, to I'm here, which is the big self-acceptance number at the end where she realizes she can love herself.
Okay, so you have this incredibly heavy, intimate story. Now let's look at 2005. This is the original Broadway production. And looking at the producers, Scott Sanders, Quincy Jones, Oprah Winfrey, this was not designed to be a small, quiet play.
Not at all. This was a juggernaut. Remember, Oprah starred in the 1985 film as Sophia?
Right, of course.
Having her name above the title was a massive marketing signal. It told audiences that this is an event. This wasn't just theater as a brand extension.
And commercially, that signal worked.
It worked incredibly well. It opened at the Broadway Theater in December 2005. It recouped its entire $11 million investment in just 1 year.
Wow.
Which is rare for a musical. By the time it closed in 2008, it had grossed over $103 million.
So if we stop there, it's a massive success story. People bought the tickets. But this is where the deep dive gets interesting. The critics didn't just dislike it. Some of them seemed actually offended by the way it was presented.
The backlash was significant.
Hmm.
And it mostly centered on the idea of spectacle versus substance.
Right.
There was a feeling that the production was trying to distract the audience from the pain of the story with glitter and bright colors.
I was reading the review from Ben Brantley of the New York Times, who was arguably the most important theater critic in the world at the time, and he was ruthless. He compared watching the show to riding a high-speed train, a TGV, through the countryside.
He called it a beat-the-clock production.
Yeah.
His argument was that the show was rushing through so much plot, trying to hit every single beat of the novel, that it lost the emotional core. It became a checklist. Here's the abuse checks. Here's the juke joint check. Here's the reunion check.
He also made a comparison to inspirational women's fiction found in airport bookstores.
Which is a very specific type of insult in the literary world.
Very specific.
It implies it was superficial, commodified emotion. Hallmark card sentimentality rather than genuine art. And he wasn't alone. David Rooney at Variety called it a big, messy patchwork. He felt it reduced this sprawling feminist saga into cartoonish episodes.
Cartoonish is a tough label for a story about systemic abuse. But was this just critics being snobs about a pop musical, or was there a deeper structural issue?
There was a specific controversy regarding the relationship between Seeley and Suge. Jeremy McCarter from New York Magazine criticized the show for what he called faith-based dramaturgy.
That's a dense phrase. Let's unpack that. What exactly did he mean by faith-based dramaturgy in this context?
He felt the production was sanitizing the story to make it palatable for a mainstream, perhaps more conservative, church-going audience.
Oh, I see.
He noted that the deep erotic love between Seeley and Suge from Alice Walker's book was reduced to timid kisses and platitudinous lyrics.
So to report on that impartially, the critique from these reviewers was that in trying to be a blockbuster for everyone, the Oprah audience, the Broadway tourists, the church groups, the production lost the specific hard edges that made the story real in the first place.
Precisely. It was oversold and overdressed.
Yeah.
The argument was that you can't take a story that raw and wrap it in that much plastic. It creates a dissonance.
Okay, so that's 2005, a commercial hit, a critical flop. Usually that's where the story ends. The show closes, it tours, it fades away. But The Color Purple did something very rare. It reinvented itself completely just 10 years later.
Enter the 2015 revival. And the context here is vital because this didn't start on Broadway. It started at the Meunier Chocolate Factory in London, directed by John Doyle in 2013.
And for those who don't follow theater directors, John Doyle isn't exactly known for big dance numbers and spinning stages.
No, his signature style is extreme minimalism. He's famous for productions where the actors also play the instruments like his Sweeney Todd. He hates clutter. He believes if the text is good, you don't need the scenery.
So he took this big lumbering creature, to quote the critics, and put it on a diet.
He stripped it to the bone. No giant sets. No massive distinct costume changes. No elaborate choreography where 50 people are dancing on tables.
Wow.
Just wooden chairs, hanging baskets on the wall, the text and the actors.
And the difference in reception is staggering. We talked about Ben Brantley, the guy who hated the 2005 version.
He completely recanted.
Completely.
When reviewing the 2015 Broadway transfer, he called it a slim, fleet-footed beauty. He said it had power within its restraint.
It's fascinating that the same critic can look at the same songs and the same story and have a totally opposite reaction just because the set changed. What does that tell us about how we consume stories?
It tells us that sometimes production value can actually be a barrier to connection. In 2005, the audience was watching a spectacle about Seeley. It was presentational. In 2015, without the distractions, they were forced to be with Seeley. The lack of scenery meant you had to look at her face.
And being with Seeley requires a powerhouse performance. We have to talk about the cast here because this revival launched some major careers.
It really did. This is what launched Cynthia Erivo into the stratosphere. She played Seeley.
I've seen clips of her performance, and incandescent is the word that keeps popping up in the reviews.
Entertainment Weekly called her performance of I'm Here a star-making moment. And it wasn't just her voice, though. Her voice is undeniable.
Right.
It was her stillness. Because the set was so minimal, she couldn't hide behind anything. She had to hold the stage with just her presence.
And she wasn't the only heavy hitter. You had Jennifer Hudson making her Broadway debut as Shug Avery.
Which brings that star power back, but in a completely different way. Variety called her radiant. And we can't forget Danielle Brooks as Sophia. A lot of people knew her from Orange is the New Black, but this was her Broadway debut too.
And she crushed it. Critics called her compulsively charismatic.
The contrast here is the key takeaway for you listening. The 2005 production was criticized for being cartoonish. The 2015 production was praised for being spiritual and honest.
Yeah.
It swept the awards. It won the 2016 Tony for Best Revival, and Cynthia Erivo won Best Actress.
It really proves that sometimes less is more isn't just a cliche, it's a valid production strategy.
Especially for a story this internal. Seeley's journey is an internal one. It's happening in her letters in her head. The 2015 production matched the outside to the inside.
Now, we've talked about the drama and the staging, but I want to circle back to the music itself. Because whether it was 2005 or 2015, the score remained the same.
It did, and it's a very clever score that does a lot of heavy lifting. It uses the music of the time period to map the emotional geography of the characters.
Give us an example of how that works in the show.
Take Push Day Button. This is Shug Avery's big number in the juke joint. It's raucous, it's bluesy, it's sexy. It represents the world of pleasure and agency that Seeley has been denied by the church and by her husband.
In contrast to the gospel influence in the rest of the show.
Right. You have tracks like Mysterious Ways, which represent the community and the church, which can be a source of comfort, but also judgment.
Yes.
But then you have the character anthems. Hell no. For Sophia, it's just pure, unadulterated defiance. It sounds like a protest march.
And I'm Here. That song has taken on a life of its own outside the show.
That's the synthesis. It starts as a quiet realization, literally talking to herself, and builds into a massive vocal declaration. It's a blues song, a gospel song, and a Broadway ballad all at once. It's the moment she integrates all the parts of herself.
It's worth noting that this music traveled. The show didn't just stay in New York or London.
No, and this speaks to the universality of the themes. In 2018, there was a major staging in Johannesburg, South Africa.
That feels incredibly significant given the themes of oppression and liberation and the history of apartheid there.
Absolutely. To hear Hell No sung in Johannesburg brings a completely different layer of historical resonance. It stops being just a story about Georgia and becomes a story about systemic oppression everywhere.
Right.
And in 2018, we also saw the first translated production in the Netherlands. Then in 2019, it went to Brazil, playing in Rio and São Paulo.
It shows that the core human struggle in Alice Walker's story, the fight to be seen, to be heard, to exist, well, it transcends the specific setting of the American South.
It does. But interestingly, after going global, the story came back to Hollywood to complete the cycle.
This brings us to the final nesting doll, the 2023 film adaptation. And just to be clear, for you listening, this isn't a remake of the Spielberg movie.
Correct. This is a movie adaptation of the stage musical. So characters break into song, fantasy sequences happen. It's a different language of film.
But the production team is a massive reunion.
It's a passing of the torch. You have Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, and Quincy Jones, all producing again the original 1985 team, along with Scott Sanders, who produced the stage show.
Right.
But the director was new. Blitz Bazalwell, who is known for Black, is king with Beyoncé.
which brought a very distinct visual style. But what I love about the 2023 film is how it honored the stage history through the casting. It felt like they were rewarding the women who kept the show alive.
Yes. The crossovers are fascinating. Take Fantasia Barrino.
The American Idol winner.
Right. She actually played Celie on Broadway back in 2007, replacing the original actress, LaShanz. Then she did the national tour in 2010.
Wow.
She lived with that role on the road. So when she was cast as Celie for the 2023 film, she had been living with this character for over 15 years.
That has to bring a depth that you just can't fake with a few months of rehearsal.
You can see it in her eyes in the film. She wears the character like a second skin. And Danielle Brooks reprised her role as Sophia from the 2015 revival.
So you have the DNA of the stage productions living in the film, but they also brought in new energy. Taraji P. Henson as Shug, Avery Coleman Domingo as Mr.
And even H.E.R. making her acting debut as Squeak and Ciara, playing the older Nettie. It was a massive ensemble.
It really feels like a victory lap for the musical. It solidified that this version of the story, the one with the songs, is now just as canonical as the original novel or the Spielberg film.
It connects the dots. It takes the cinematic scope of the 1985 movie, the big landscapes, the production value, and merges it with the internal monologue that the musical songs provide.
So when we step back and look at this whole journey, what is the big takeaway? We went from a production in 2005 that critics called a messy patchwork to a 2015 revival that was a fleet-footed beauty to a 2023 film that celebrates both.
I think the key insight here is about trust. The 2005 production, perhaps feeling the weight of the Spielberg legacy and the Oprah brand, felt the need to be big.
Right.
It needed to justify its existence with spectacle. It didn't trust that the audience would care about a poor Black woman in the South unless it was wrapped in glitter.
And in doing so, it maybe drowned out the very thing people came to see.
Exactly. The 2015 revival trusted the audience. It trusted that if you just put actors on a stage and let them tell the truth of Celie's trauma and her joy, the audience would go with you. You didn't need the high-speed train.
It's a lesson for any storyteller, really. If the core is strong, you don't need to dress it up. In fact, dressing it up might hide the point.
And it also speaks to how we view adaptations. The critics in 2005 felt the show was sanitized. Remember that faith-based dramaturgy comment?
Yeah.
They felt it smoothed over the rough edges of the lesbian romance and the brutality. The 2015 version, by stripping away the distraction, forced a confrontation with those harder truths.
It raises a really provocative question for you listening. We often think of adaptations as getting worse or further away from the original source material the more they happen. Like a game of telephone where the message just gets garbled over time.
But in this case, the argument could be made that by adapting it again, refining it, stripping it down, the musical actually got closer to the truth of Alice Walker's novel than the original Broadway production did.
Does an adaptation eventually find its way back home if you give it enough tries? That is something to chew on.
And if you want to hear the difference yourself, I have a homework assignment for you. Go stream the cast recordings. Listen to the 2005 version, then listen to the 2015 revival.
Can you actually hear the difference in the audio?
You absolutely can. You can hear the difference between performing at an audience projecting to the back row and sharing with an audience drawing them in. It's palpable.
That is a great place to leave it. Go stream those albums and decide for yourself. Thank you for diving deep with us today into the world of The Color Purple.
It was a pleasure.
We will see you on the next deep dive.